This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
It said to me that basically you could have a bar fight from here to eternity on global warming science with someone, but if you start the conversation off talking about energy efficiency, you could have a completely different outcome.
Here's a poll question for you. Would you support a tax increase to fund renewable energy? Or is it just not fair to ask about a tax increase in mid-April? Well, no, it's probably not fair. How and even when you ask questions can substantively influence your poll results. This week on Sea Change Radio, we talk with noted environmental journalist Andrew Revkin about a recent Yale-Utah State survey and mapping project designed to capture American attitudes about climate change and related policy. With 30 years covering science and environmental issues for the New York Times under his belt, Revkin has a distinct perspective, one he uses to analyze the language and the findings of the study. We talk about whether the poll results signal a hopeful sign, how the environmental debate does and doesn't fall along the red-blue divide, and how political rhetoric shifts depending on the audience. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Andrew Revkin. He teaches communications at Pace University, and he's a longtime environmental journalist and writes the .earth blog on the New York Times. Andy, welcome back to Sea Change Radio.
Good to be with you.
So recently, you penned a piece for the Times entitled "No Red and Blue Divide When It Comes to Renewable Energy Innovation and CO2 Rules." Why don't you give us first a brief summary of this piece?
Yeah, well, at Yale University, there's been since 2009, they've been doing a very valuable set of surveys tracking American attitudes about global warming and related questions like, you know, what do you want to do about energy? What are your religious interests or beliefs? It's kind of like tracking climate change. What I like about this particular effort is it's like the Gallup and Pew. The whole idea is to develop a consistent picture over time. And what they did this past year is they worked with people at Utah State University to dig in more in a geographical way, compiling thousands of survey responses right down. And then they've gotten down to the level of individual counties, of voting districts, and kind of created maps of U.S. attitudes about these kinds of questions. And they break down what Americans think, not just about global warming, but about what you might do about it. And I've seen and I've written about other surveys, both by this same group and others, that show that when you look at things like energy efficiency or the need for more research on energy technologies, you often see a lot more commonality than you do when you just sort of say, do you believe in global warming or do you think global warming is a serious problem? That issue has gotten really kind of toxic. It's become very politicized. People kind of have, whether they think about it this way or not, there's a lot of people in our country now and for whom it's the equivalent of a lapel badge on abortion rights or gun rights, or where it's your overall worldview or your tribal identity gets in the way of your how you present what you think about science. And this map was no different. They had an estimated percent of Americans, of adults who are worried about global warming. The map looks kind of like an electoral map. It's very divided. California and New York are worried. Illinois is kind of pretty worried. But there are the usual suspects, states that are dependent on fossil fuels in the Midwest and in the Dakotas and areas that depend where the economy is wrapped around fossil fuels, or where there's just a, you know, libertarian conservative streak or blue, just like they would be in a political map.
But some of the bigger swing states, like Florida, for example, and then possibly the biggest oil state, Texas, is in more of the moderate to worried section.
Yeah, and that's kind of interesting. Texas could be a function of, and there are other surveys that have shown if you have direct experience with climate extremes, or it tends to make you more focused on those kinds of questions. And Texas had its heat and drought and fires last couple of years. So that's a whole separate question. But then when you get down to the sort of what do you do about it maps, things get interesting in a hurry. Estimated percentage of adults who support regulating CO2 as a pollutant. And that map is kind of like those states I mentioned that are worried about global warming are cherry red, sort of cherry red. But everyone else is either yes or yeah, they're all in the sort of plus column on this, ranging from just over half of the population to solid majorities think that regulating CO2 as a pollutant is a good idea. Another one that's even where you have an even wider support is estimated percentage of adults who support funding research into renewable energy sources. And that map is almost uniformly, I'd say, strong majorities are very enthusiastic, if not like, you know, really kind of have their fists raised, you know, to push that idea. So that, and that meshes a lot with what I've seen in some other surveys of this sort, that if you separate out the energy arguments from the climate science arguments, you immediately get a lot more people aligned. And I think it's a really valuable thing to do. When you talk about a tax, things go different. Estimated percent of adults who support a carbon tax, if revenues are refunded to every American household, even with that Jim Hansen style tax and dividend approach, only New York State is marginally supportive. Everyone else is in the blue zone. So that says to me, again, talk of a tax in America is really challenging. There's ways forward in that arena. Obviously, not everyone calls it a tax. There was some encouraging developments in the House and recently in the Congress where with low oil prices, even Republicans were calling for a quote unquote user fee to basically bolster the gasoline tax, the federal tax. And that struck me as a really promising avenue to push on, because basically what climate campaigners and scientists who are concerned about warming talk about is we have to stop treating the atmosphere like a free dump for waste products and having, so essentially a user fee for the atmosphere would be the equivalent of a cost on the carbon we want to put there. And so I think if you get people starting to think about things in that way, you could even get libertarians or people who have limited government approach to their lives and philosophies engaged in meaningful discussions. And too often we end up in these sort of, you know, yes or no, denier, believer kinds of frames that are not productive.
Yes, and it is encouraging. I want to break down the methodology of these surveys a little bit more and talk about what it might mean in the future. But let's speculate, or if you have actual statistics to back it up, on how this has maybe evolved over the last 5 to 10 years. And in particular, I would imagine that the question of how worried are you about global warming has changed quite a bit over the years.
Gallup has been at this a really long time. And they have recently put out their latest numbers on concerns about global warming. And this goes back to 1989, which is, I started writing about global warming in 1988. So this is, you know, right back to the beginning, before the IPCC and the Framework Convention on Climate Change and everything else. And when you look at that, the answers to those questions, how worried are you, very worried or somewhat worried about global warming? This is the metric that I have described as being essentially like water sloshing in a shallow pan. That's the best analogy I've come up to describe it. There's a lot of variability between 1989 and now, but it's not the depth, meaning the level of concern, the level of engagement hasn't changed at all. There was a big slosh of concern in the mid to late 2000s around the release of An Inconvenient Truth. Periodically, when there's an IPCC report out, it kind of sloshes, but the depth doesn't change. It's still a shallow pan. And that's, if you're a politician, and I wrote about this first in 2006, quoting Helen Ingram at UC Irvine, who said basically, the things that get you into a voting booth are things that are soon, salient, and certain. And when you think about global warming, it has embedded characteristics that are kind of the antithesis of that. I don't see any signs it's becoming more of a voting issue. And energy, though, again, there's the same folks, the Yale team that put out this study with Utah State, have done this other Six Americas survey with people at George Mason since 2009. And there you see, I don't think it's a strengthening pattern, but it's a very strong pattern that people who differ a lot on their views of global warming have a lot more concordance on what do we do about energy. And I quoted, I did a piece a few years ago, energy agreement hidden by climate disputes. And there's even, I put up some PowerPoint slides to show this. It's very powerful where if you asked people in 2009, would you support the cap and trade bill for global warming, which was the big deal that year, even people who were alarmed about global warming in their survey were basically like, meh, to use my son's term. Not even really, it was sort of a total maybe on whether they would think that cap and trade was a solution. If you asked everyone in that survey, from people who were alarmed to people who were doubtful and disengaged, whether they would support tighter standards for car mileage, a higher standard for car gas mileage, even if it costs more money, and virtually everyone says yes. And only the dismissives on global warming say are kind of below the midline. It said to me that basically you could have a bar fight from here to eternity on global warming science with someone, but if you start the conversation off talking about energy efficiency, you could have a completely different outcome in the course of an evening. And that's to me, I just try to look for those opportunities.
If you're gonna live, then live it up. And if you're gonna give, then give it up. If you're gonna walk the earth, then walk it proud. And if you're gonna say the word, got to say it loud. Say you gotta fight, fight, fight for your mind. You gotta fight, fight, fight for your mind. Why? You got to fight, fight, fight for your mind.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Andrew Revkin. He's a communications professor at Pace University, and he runs the .Earth blog at the New York Times. Andy, this may be a leap, but a lot of liberal policymakers, progressives, tend to maybe give the American people too much credit, thinking that they're going to do their research, that they're going to get into the nuts and bolts and really understand what cap and trade might be, for example, and say the messaging isn't as important, while the Republicans focus a lot more on the window dressing around something like the Clear Skies Act or something that might be opposite of what it actually is trying to do, but it's all in how it's phrased. And I think that a lot of this information coming from the surveys highlight this. I remember, and you linked to it in your in this post in the Times that we will link to from Sea Change Radio, from a couple of years ago, that conservatives will not embrace a green light bulb if it has the term green in it. It has to be energy efficient. There's certain buzzwords that will turn people off.
There's been lots of cogitation within the quote unquote progressive community about where do we go from here, given that so many efforts to nudge the public have not worked. Just a few days ago, I was involved with an online webinar about climate communication. And, I said one thing I think we have to get over, whatever your ideology, is that this is a sort of a sales pitch kind of question. As you were saying, it's pretty clear on the science that more science information isn't the thing that tips people out into a new way of thinking about things, whether it's anti-vaccine folks who are, you may have seen studies that show that if you, the more you barrage someone who's dug in on vaccination against it with studies showing that it's safe, the more resistant they become. And there's a lot of the same dynamic in the climate change arena. And that says to me, it just gives it that much more credence to the idea of moving, finding areas of common ground, and this is in the policy arena as well. Roger Pilkey Jr., a political scientist at Colorado State, at University of Colorado, who has been controversial in some circles, but who is very heavily published in this area, he says, he quotes Walter Lippmann from a long time ago, saying that whatever your issue, politics is not about getting everybody to feel the same or believe the same. It's about getting people who believe differently to do the same thing. And that's where, again, you know, if a Republican is talking about a user fee instead of a gas tax, I pay attention to that.
Yeah, and that's promising Republicans will, that House Republicans realize there is a problem that needs to be addressed. It's just a question of framing it to get the result that we all want, which is cleaner air and water. So one of the takeaways that I got also from the cap and trade question was that it really revealed that something's wrong with how cap and trade is being promoted. Like, it's not well understood.
Oh, yeah.
For example, so this estimated percentage of adults who support a carbon tax if revenues are refunded to every American household is tepid at best from every demographic. But to me, that shows that those who are disengaged on the issue of climate change altogether and those who are alarmed about climate change both agree that cap and trade isn't such a good idea. And to me, that's more of a reflection of them not understanding the complexity of the issue, that they need to not use the jargon of cap and trade and focus on things like creating a market for carbon allowances.
Yeah, and this gets to, by the way, this gets to the area where my friends who are more focused on the Beltway, you know, how do you get things done in Washington? They say a lot of this is a distraction. Bloggers like Joe Rahm at the Center for American Progress. Well, he said a few years back that, you know, he's not writing his blog for all of Americans. He's writing, I think he said it was like 20,000 people he thinks matter. And, you know, they're mostly within the Washington sphere. And just look at the healthcare bill. It's a perfect example where, you know, that most Americans, including me, never really understood that bill fully. Or look at Obama's negotiations with Iran over preventing them from having the capacity to develop a nuclear weapon, even while they move forward with nuclear energy. That stuff, I guarantee you, the same way, most Americans haven't a clue about the details of and merits and limits of different arguments. And so in that arena, it is much more about strategy, about finding ways to move a bill forward, as Obama did with the healthcare bill, even when you were facing really polarized and difficult architecture in Congress. So that, you know, in a certain sense, a lot of what we're discussing doesn't matter to people focused on the strategic approach to passing a bill or moving forward with some other government initiative.
But when you take into account things like the Republican-led Congress at least considering a gas tax, but rolling it back in terms of communication and framing it differently, it really does have effect for all of us. This is not, we're not just quibbling over the wording or framing. It actually leads to important decisions for our country and the planet.
Yeah, and I think I do. That's why, obviously that's why I keep doing what I do. You know, I do think communication matters. It just is important to, I think it's just really important to kind of understand what would matter. I just thought of a completely different arena that's relevant. Like in the mid-2000s in China, conservation groups that were worried about shark depletions of shark fisheries, sharks through the fishery for shark fin soup, started developing a social media campaign to try to discourage the middle class in China from consuming so much shark fin soup. And they started wisely by doing a survey. And I just spoke about this. I've written about it several times. They found that one big thing in China was that most Chinese people that they interviewed didn't know that shark fin soup contains shark. And the reason is the name in Chinese for shark fin soup is just fin soup.
Right. If, like, let's say pigs were rare and were endangered, and what pork is pig? But people don't necessarily connect the dots. At least my 7-year-old hasn't quite figured it out all the time.
Yeah. So, you know, it's a perfect example. And then, so they did put together a really effective social media campaign involving celebrities and Yao Ming, the huge basketball star. And it has apparently really changed people's attitudes and even allowed the government, has canceled shark fin soup at official banquets and that kind of thing. So it's really built into something of a movement. But it started with knowing you know, knowing what you need to do.
Right. It's kind of like the Steve Martin, I think, was the character in the early Saturday Night Live skit where he was Socrates and he's walking in the forum and he's like, everybody's like, Socrates, what's the meaning of life? All these big questions. Nobody ever comes and tells me, Socrates, hemlock is poison. You know, so like we don't necessarily. So this shark fin soup campaign was ripe for an onion spoof or something saying, what? There's shark and shark fin soup?
Exactly. Well, so anyway, it just shows you do your homework before you come up with a campaign.
Or before you eat something like hemlock, make sure read the label.
Yeah. So again, I think it's important for people to, especially for foundations and others who are funding efforts to pursue progress on decarbonization. If you know from the start that better science communication may in fact simply get people more dug in their bunkers, then that might not be where you'd want to stress where you put your money, as opposed to into energy communication, where you know you already have sort of two tides that are flowing in the same direction. And again, obviously, I'm a science communicator, so it's not like I'm saying that doesn't mean science communication doesn't matter. It absolutely matters, but it's not the thing that necessarily is going to change people or change the country's political dynamic on a question like this.
I got something I want to talk about to you. Just a little communication.
Change Radio is made possible by support from Presidio Graduate School in San Francisco, offering MBA and MPA degrees in sustainable management. Learn more at presidio.edu.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Andrew Revkin. He's a communications professor at Pace University, and he runs the Dot Earth blog at the New York Times. He's a longtime environmental journalist. Andy, talking about the political dynamic, we're kind of starting to creep into silly season for the 2016 election. Do you think that, looking at this data here, do you think that a Republican candidate can debate a Democratic candidate and with a straight face say that he or she doesn't believe in climate change? Because that's become, not believing in climate change has become one of the litmus tests for a conservative candidate.
Well, you know, the architecture of becoming president as a Republican requires going through this process of swinging as far as you can back to the right when you go through the primary process. So what you're going to see, as you did the last few years since the mid-2000s, is everyone initially who wants to become the nominee is going to have to completely reject climate science, because that's the badge. Remember, the badge of identity for the hardcore Republican conservative base. But then you'll see them swing a shapeshift toward the actual election into more moderate language, where they accept the science, but they don't think it's as dangerous as Al Gore thought it was, and they think there's paths forward that don't involve attacks. You'll see that kind of nuancing. This happened. I interviewed John McCain before he was running for office, and after he'd been to the Arctic, and he was very concerned about Arctic climate change and vulnerabilities. And of course, then magically swung way to the right and forgot everything. Newt Gingrich did the same thing, and he's been locked in place at the edge ever since I interviewed him around that same time, the mid to late 2000s. And he was all very concerned about global warming. He stressed that he was a conservationist before he was a politician, and on and on. And now, if you listen to him now, it's like you know, the classic will the real Newt Gingrich please stand up? And you'll see more of that. It'll be the same. And I wouldn't want to have to go through that process myself. It just must be because somewhere there lies someone's actual beliefs.
Right. So if we were going to tweak the methodology behind these studies, the Yale University studies, so the most popular one was supporting funding research into renewable energy. If we played with the language, you put on your communications professor's hat for a second. If you were going to play with that language and ask the same question but in a different way, if you want to get a lower response, what would you change it to?
You would say solar energy, solar, because there's been that got to be a toxic issue with the Obama stimulus money for Solyndra.
Or if you put anything like, if you would you support the Obama administration's efforts to continue to fund research into renewable energy, you'd get like a very divided response, I'm guessing.
Yeah, and actually, if you said clean energy, implicitly including nuclear as well as renewables, you probably get an even higher response. So surveys always have to be taken with a grain of salt. You have to look at the language, and that's why it's important to look across different surveys to be sure that there's you're not being sort of carried along on a in a confirmation bias way. Well, the survey confirms my biases, therefore it must be correct.
So, for example, this is pretty low concern for global warming, I thought, but you thought it was encouraging. But if we were going to say, do you believe that global warming exists, do you think it would be more divided responses or less?
There's a lot of concern that we need to work on public understanding of the scientific consensus on global warming. That when you look at, and some of the Yale people and others have done work on this, when you look at what the public thinks about the scientific, whether scientists are divided about global warming, the public is much more apt to, voters are much more apt to doubt that there is a consensus than the facts that are revealed by surveys of scientists. I think all of that is mostly, obviously I'd like to think the public is more in line with what scientists think, whether it's about global warming or about GMOs or about risks from nuclear power or about, vaccination than is the case. And global warming, but I think it's not a transformative thing. The key thing here is that everything matters, making sure that we experiment actively with new ways to spread basic literacy about climate science is really important. One reason I wrote my North Pole book for young adults, for fifth, sixth, seventh graders, is to reach down the chain. So that's all important, but it's not necessarily going to be the thing that galvanizes change in things that matter. I try to focus more and more, now that I'm in the latter part of my career, 30 years of science writing, if I have 30 more, that would be a miracle. So I'm kind of like over the hump. I'm trying to focus more on what actually matters. What would change things? What are the kinds of communication efforts I or my students can work on that can actually sort of make a difference? And they're less about conveying the science of climate change and more about conveying the opportunities in energy advances or in getting family planning to the right place at the right time or in finding smart ways to raise crops that are more efficient and less damaging or in promoting work by folks who are finding ways to get distributed power in places where that'll never be on a grid, in parts of India or sub-Saharan Africa. I just feel more excitement, less roadblocks when I focus my communication efforts in areas like that.
Well, you're doing terrific work, and people who aren't following you on Twitter or reading your work at .earth are missing out. Andy Revkin, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you. Take care.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Trombone Shorty, Ben Harper, and Bobby Womack. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.